Good morning, colleagues. The House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Welcome to the interim committee hearing. Hopefully we'll have some interesting discussion today. But first, it is my pleasure to welcome to the committee Representative Barbara Smith Warner. Representative Smith Warner, would you care to introduce yourself and say a couple of words about who you are?
Sure. My name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I am the newly appointed representative for House District 45, replacing Representative Dembro, on behalf of the good people of Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And this is my third day and my third committee hearing, and I'm thrilled to be here, drinking from the fire hose and learning more information in a short period of time than I thought I ever would. And I'm thrilled to be here and look forward to learning a lot more this morning.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a packed agenda today. We'll start actually at the end, open a work session on bill introduction. And colleagues, as a reminder, we have three LCs here. We generally view introduction of committee measures as a courtesy. I do want to make a special comment about LC 57. LC 57 will not come forward as it's seen in the bill. It is a vehicle for a concept that is being worked on related to weatherization, and I just wanted to make that clear as we're moving forward. So with that, unless there are any questions, I'd entertain a motion.
Chair Bailey, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 51, dated 01-6 of 2014, LC 54, dated 12-18 of 2013, and LC 57, dated 1-16-2014.
Vice Chair Johnson moves that the following committee bills be introduced, the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 51, dated 1-6-2014, LC 54, dated 12-18-2013, LC 57, dated 1-16-2014. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. We'll close the work session on bill introduction and open an informational meeting on LC 54 relating to net metering of energy produced by marine resources.
And I can just do this from here.
Great.
Because I'm going to introduce somebody else.
Wherever you would like, from here.
Okay.
Or from the
I'm Deborah Boone from House District 32, and this bill was, this is pretty much a housekeeping bill, but I'm going to turn it over to Colonel Safe from the Guard and Camp Raylia, where he will explain to you what this does, why they need it, and we have for backup Rick Williams and Jason Bush, Director of OWET.
Great. Why don't we have Lieutenant Colonel Ken Safe and Richard Williams come on up, please.
Jason's just going to sit back in case they need him.
Okay, that sounds good. And whatever I would like to start can start.
Good morning, Chairman Bailey, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Safe, the Construction and Facility Management Officer for the Military Department. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm here to support LC 54, the inclusion of wave energy as a renewable energy resource for net metering. The language does three things. It adds marine energy converters to wind and solar. It clarifies the renewable energy generated from the sea as opposed to from lakes or rivers. And it defines the connectivity to the generator customer. Adding this to the existing statute will benefit OMD and others along the Oregon coast. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory provided a study for the Oregon Military Department titled Targeting Net Zero Energy at Oregon Army National Guard Sites. The assessment and recommendations, they identified both wind and wave energy in the report as potential renewable resources. Wind is supported by the current net metering statute, but wave is not. The Oregon Military Department conducted a study to determine the feasibility of using ocean renewable energy as a generation resource. The initial goal of such a facility would be to service the energy needs of Camp Raylia. With the net metering statute amended to include wave energy, the Oregon Military Department could acquire and use this renewable energy for the energy needs there. Oregon is an ideal location for ocean energy conversion based primarily on its tremendous wave resource and wind resource. Marine energy converters include many designs for wave energy, hybrid wave wind energy, and offshore floating wind systems that can be connected to shore by submarine power cables. A shore station could house controls, power conditioning, and transformers to ensure the power meets grid integration standards for net metering requirements. Energy independence and energy security are operational imperatives for the military department. Renewable energy sources are important alternatives to the electrical grid and fossil fuels for the backup generator that we have at Camp Rylea. Camp Rylea requires renewable energy to meet mission requirements, including disaster recovery in the event that wind storms, earthquakes, or flooding disrupts the electrical grid. Given the hard work done by the Territorial Sea Plan Advisory Committee to revise Part 5 of the Territorial Sea Plan, it makes sense to include wave energy in the net metering law. TISPAC revised Part 5 so that it clarifies the state's preference to initiate development through pilot project and phase development. Net metering will help enable this to happen. This includes my testimony. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Williams.
Chair, Vice Chairs, for the record, my name is Rick Williams. I'm an Oregon City resident and an Oregon State University graduate in construction engineering. For background on my comments, I'm a retired sea captain with over 35 years of experience in ocean and systems engineering and program management. I represent a company, Leidos Maritime, or Leidos, and I'm in the Maritime Solutions branch of that. We're a global research and engineering company. I've been with that company for over 10 years. I'm a founding member of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust and testified on the Oregon Innovation Council competition for Oregon's next emerging industry, which selected the Wave Energy Initiative. And I'm supporting the Oregon Military Department in systems engineering, system integration, and program management. I'd like to make 4 points, if I may. The LC-54 makes sense from an engineering perspective. It makes sense from a programmatic perspective. It makes sense from a stakeholder outreach perspective. And finally, it makes sense from the perspective of responsible development of wave energy in Oregon. Camp Rylea has a vital mission. It's important to the economic development of the North Coast. In fact, it's one of the most significant economic engines of Clatsop County. It's important to emergency management with the new Emergency Operations Center at Camp Rylea. The camp has a small load, 500 kilowatts, which is small, with peaks to 900 kilowatts. It's got a beach landing for submarine power cables. And probably most importantly, it has a professional engineering staff, as represented by the Colonel, a professional facilities management staff, and a professional environmental compliance staff with over 30 years of baseline data for Camp Rylea. That's unmatched in the state. If I may, from the engineering side, I led the feasibility study the Colonel referenced, and my team is working on the current effort to initiate the conceptual design. I feel that wave energy will be viable at Camp Rylea before it's viable anyplace else in Oregon, and I feel it'll be viable in Oregon before it's viable anyplace else in the country. Camp Rylea is best suited in Oregon for small-scale, early-phase projects, and net metering is the first step from the engineering side. Understanding that the engineering solution is the point of departure to reality, the programmatic side, and how you pay for it. The recommended development approach approved by the state in the Territorial Sea Plan is to start with temporary testing and then do small-scale phase development. Submarine power cables are very expensive, and grid connection is very expensive, so net metering is the programmatic next step that makes sense. From a stakeholder standpoint, with the help of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust, we've collaborated with Pacific Corps, who is neutral and recommended an amendment, which Beth has been provided. We've collaborated with the public utilities, the municipal utilities, the co-ops, and they do not object to the proposal. It's been brought to the attention of the Oregon Department of Energy, the PUC, and the Citizens Utility Board. And probably most importantly, the existing marine stakeholders, when we first met with them, asked us to start small and prove that this stuff works before it gets expanded. The way to do that is after temporary testing, connect it with a cable ashore, and the way to connect the cable to the grid is through the net metering regulations. So net metering is the best scale for start small and prove it. And finally, the Oregon Wave Energy Trust mission is responsible development of wave energy in Oregon. Oregon is the best place in the United States because of the resource, the location of the grid, and the population centers. We need to test, demonstrate, and evaluate over a long term that this stuff will work, and Camp Riley is the best place to do that. So in summary, net metering of marine renewable energy makes sense for Oregon. It makes sense at Camp Riley, and I support the legislative concept. Subject to your questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to comment and thank both Lieutenant Colonel Stave and Captain Williams, and just kind of remind you my base mission on a lot of this, that the work that I do in the legislature is based on emergency preparedness and the fact that the military has stepped up. We didn't ask them to. They are doing that, and it really works out well for us to have this pilot starting at Camp Rylea, because that is in Clatsop County, North Coast, the go-to place. The military has been, the Guard has been very responsive in addressing our emergency needs and disaster, and they're very much a part of our resilience work, and this makes sense, and I was more than happy to have this be another piece of the puzzle that we're going to, when we develop this renewable energy source. So thank you very much, both of you, for all the work you've done. A short time in front of us and a very short synopsis of it, but they've done, piles of work on this. So thank you for allowing us to have this be a committee bill.
Thank you for your work on it. Other questions for this panel? So just to be clear, the sheet of paper entitled draft is the proposed amendment that has been worked out. Is that correct? And you're both supportive of that amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. And I'm seeing some smiles around the room. All right. Thumbs ups. All right. Good. If there are no further questions, thank you for your work on this, and we'll move on to the next subject. Okay, we'll close the informational hearing relating to net metering of energy produced by marine resources. Open an informational meeting on renewable portfolio standard. I think we should start with Ted Case and Werner Seaman. The Vice Chair brings up a good point. I should clarify for the committee in general on the LCs that we are exploring in this committee hearing that these are informational hearings on the LCs. We will still have public hearings and the normal course of business during session once it opens. These informational hearings are for the purpose of exploring some of the issues contained within those concepts. The purpose of this informational hearing is to get an update and hear about the discussions and the work group that's been happening around issues related to the renewable portfolio standard and the potential implications of Initiative Petition 3. So, gentlemen, we'd be delighted to have you kick us off and tell us what you've been up to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, serving about 200,000 consumers in the most rural and remote parts of the state. Our power primarily comes from the federal dams off the Columbia River system, although we have also invested in wave energy, geothermal energy, and solar energy, and some wind energy. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the RPS Task Force and the work that's been going on with that since, I think, mid-September is when we started. We've had several meetings in around Portland, Salem. We actually went to Hood River. The membership, I think, is around 12 folks or so. And I think the overall implication of it was to look at the RPS in its totality and some of the opportunities and challenges. The one that really came to the forefront for my membership was what to do with small non-generating electric co-ops that because of the data centers that have moved into primarily Eastern Oregon that find themselves thrust into the large standard of the RPS, the 25% standard. Specifically, Umatilla Electric Cooperative based in Hermiston, a 10,000 member co-op, really sort of mid-sized for my membership, is getting a lot of this data center load, and it finds itself quickly, and by 2018 will be in the glide path to the large standard. And the cost implications of that was something that this task force really grappled with. What does it mean to be thrown into that standard for a 10,000 member co-op to go into 25%, which the same standard for 800,000 member PGE or close to 600,000 member Pacific Corps. And what we found, and I think what the Oregon Department of Energy will talk to you about later, is that there was some pretty serious cost implications of that. In fact, in the order of about $75-76 million, to the point where they get to 25%. So the issue was what to do about that, how to find some sort of compliance, some sort of tools that the co-op could use to try to smooth those costs and to mitigate the enormous costs that could come with that. And what we found after looking at a lot of different solutions, and the gentleman to my right, Varner Seaman, was very helpful in looking at this as whether other members of the committee, is we found that perhaps the use of unbundled renewable energy certificates, unbundled RECs, was one way to help smooth the costs for electric cooperatives. And so I'm pleased to say I think we have an agreement. A lot of details need to be worked out, but we have an agreement for a enhanced use of those unbundled RECs for co-ops that go into that large standard, or consumer and utilities that go into that large standard. Sort of a glide path, starting 100%, ratcheting down to 75%. And I'll let Odo talk about sort of the metrics of all of that. And what we found is that will be some significant cost savings and really help Umatilla in particular meet the standard without, you know, significant rate shock. So along with that, the agreement goes, that would obviate the need for a ballot measure that's currently out there for Hydro's renewable. And we'd have sort of a general detente along the issue of the RPS, which we found, and the chairman knows as well, is a very emotional issue, passionate issue on both sides. It was worked out in 2007 over a lot of blood spilled, I think. I was not here for that, but I've heard the stories. And I think there's a general perception and understanding that we stand down on that a little bit. We work on some other things. And, you know, as long as we can work this out. So, again, there's general agreement. A lot of details need to be worked out in the short time we have, and we know that the session is very fleeting. So we're working hard to try to get all that pulled together. And I do want to commend Representative Greg Smith and Margie Hoffman for their work keeping this group together. There were times that looked like things were coming off the rails a little bit, but they kept at it, kept us in the room, kept us talking. And again, I want to also commend the Oregon Department of Energy that I know will come up here, but their modeling and statistics and data that they brought us really helped, I think, break the gridlock that we had. It just showed the costs so I want to commend Lisa Schwartz and Julie Peacock for their work as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions when appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we go to Mr. Seaman, and then we'll take questions.
Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director at Renewable Northwest Project. Thank you for the time to talk about this today. I first want to also give some thanks to Representative Greg Smith and Margie in the governor's office for their work on the task force. I agree they did a good job in terms of holding the committee together, and I think these were some hard conversations, but I think some good conversations over the last few months. Also want to welcome Representative Smith Warner to the exciting world of energy policy. The look on your faces, we're talking about the RPS stuff here. It's a little bit tricky. I'm sure the rest of your committee members will talk about how exciting this work is. So welcome. First, I want to say that for the state of Oregon, we think the renewable portfolio standard is an important policy, both in terms of shifting to lower carbon energy resources, as well as a strong economic development policy for the state of Oregon. I'd remind members of the committee, and I think most of you have heard us testify on this before, that to date, Oregon's RPS, as well as the renewable portfolio standards in Washington and California, have led to about $9 billion in investment in rural Oregon over the last decade or so. Corresponding with this, we've had a pretty significant amount of job creation and construction activity, and I think that when we look at who are some of the strongest supporters of the RPS on a going forward basis and continuing some of that investment, it is the county judges in the affected counties where a lot of this development is occurring. And you know, for what we've seen from the Oregon Department of Oregon Employment Department in a report last year was that the three counties in the state of Oregon that had job growth through the Great Recession were in part three counties that had wind development occurring in their counties, and that there was a pretty significant amount of job creation and development that occurred through a pretty tough time in our state's history. Few other things that we saw through this task force. I think on the question of hydropower, which was discussed a little bit in this task force, I think it's worth noting first that there is a protection for consumer-owned utilities in the state that receive Tier 1 Bonneville power. Currently, that no utility could be required to displace Tier 1 federal hydropower under the RPS and have to procure new renewables and therefore forego some of their hydropower allotment from the Bonneville Power Administration. We think this is an important protection and one that's worth noting. It was also interesting to note through this process, and there was work that the Bonneville Power Administration did to provide us with data on the efficiency upgrades that are happening to the federal hydropower system and the work that the Oregon Department of Energy did to analyze the impact of those efficiency upgrades. And it's worth noting that in Oregon's renewable portfolio standard, efficiency upgrades to the existing federal hydro system count towards the RPS. And what we saw is that for many consumer-owned utilities in the state of Oregon, a significant portion of their renewable portfolio standard compliance obligation will be met with efficiency upgrades. So just to put a little bit of a picture on this, so when Bonneville goes and does work on the Grand Coulee Dam, they take out an aging turbine, they put in a new turbine, which has a higher capacity rating, produces more power. That additional power can count towards the renewable portfolio standard in Oregon. So on the basic underlying question of, is hydropower counted as a renewable resource in Oregon? Yes, that is one place where it is counted as a renewable resource and will be counted on a going forward basis. So we also discovered through this process that for ratepayers in the state of Oregon, largely the compliance obligation is falling today on two utilities that have early compliance targets, PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric, that I think as committees have heard in the past, the rate impact to date of the renewable portfolio standard has been fairly minimal, at or less than 1% to date for the early procurement targets within the renewable portfolio standard. Generally speaking, when we talked through this process, what we learned was that most utilities and load-serving entities in the state are fine with how the renewable portfolio standard is structured. There isn't a tremendous amount of controversy around the renewable portfolio standard, and generally folks are fine with it. What we did discover is that for some small utilities that are going to be experiencing or are experiencing pretty significant load growth, really from data centers coming in, and I think what Ted was referencing were two utilities in particular, Central Oregon Electric Co-op, based in Redmond, serving the Redmond Bend area, that has some data center activity, as well as the Umatilla Electric Co-op in northeastern part of the state that are having some data center activity coming in, that those utilities are going to move from having 5 or 10% compliance obligation under the RPS to a 25% compliance obligation. We had a lot of conversation around the existing protections in the RPS. There's a cap on the cost of the RPS of 4% rate increases, so rates may not increase because of the RPS by more than 4% for the customers of any utility in the state. We talked about that quite a bit. We talked about what was going to happen with the data centers coming on, and we were able to, I think, address the concerns of these two utilities that were experiencing this load growth and to say, yes, if we give some additional flexibility in being able to use unbundled renewable energy certificates that ratchets down over time as the compliance obligation ratchets up for those utilities, that would go a long way towards offsetting some of the concerns the folks had that I think Ted was mentioning a moment ago in terms of what the cost of compliance of the RPS would be. One of the things that we believe was good about the design of the RPS and remains to be a strong part of the RPS is that there is a significant amount of flexibility for utilities in terms of how they do their procurement under the RPS and how they comply. And we think that there are some pretty good protections in place, and we want to make sure that this is a reasonable policy which is possible for utilities to meet and to move forward on. And again, we think the RPS is good policy for the state. For what it's worth, in terms of the impact for renewable energy development in the state, we believe that there will be, with this compromise, some impact on the future of renewable energy development, but not until the 2020 timeframe. We think that there will be a loss of about 12 to 40 equivalent wind megawatts. So that's about 4 to 12 turbines that wouldn't be built, or the delay, there would be some delay of the construction of these turbines. And we think for protection of the overall policy, this is a reasonable compromise. And we're happy to support as we get the details worked out and the finishing up the work on this compromise. We're happy to support as it goes forward.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Is the 4% rate increase each year limited to?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's an overall increase for the RPS, and I think that the Department of Energy has done some pretty good modeling to show how that could work. So it isn't a compounding rate increase, so it wouldn't be 4%, 4%, 4%. It's basically a 4% over what the cost of doing business would be if the RPS weren't in place. It's recalculated on an ongoing basis, but it isn't something that accumulates or sort of compounds over time.
Follow up. Just what time frame are we looking at as related to the 4%? I understand it's not compounded, but what are you looking at as a...
So I think the Oregon Department of Energy can speak to it better, but my recollection of sort of the modeling that we had, in particular for Umatilla, I think they hit the cost cap in year 7 or year 8 of their compliance. And I think that was one of the issues we really looked at, because the issue was, well, what is the true cost going to be? And until we had these models and we saw that they're going to bump against that, I think, again, that really helped us make some educated decisions on how to smooth those costs out. And that's where we came up with these renewable energy certificates.
Well, first of all, thank you for your hard work on this very difficult subject. So I'm just curious, with the shifting of, with all the changes that you've made, would there be any difference in the competitive advantage of, say, one part of the utility industry compared to another part of the utility industry, and by competitive, in terms of attracting wind farms, or not wind farms, but server farms and so forth? So any
Well, I mean, from our perspective, this was never about, seeking a competitive advantage to anybody else in the state. It was really we have an obligation to serve these data centers for a variety of reasons, are attracted to some of our service territory out in the northeast part of the state. And, because of the size of the co-ops in general, the impacts would have been bigger. So from our perspective, it was not about, trying to be the dumping ground for every data center in the state. It was simply, if they come, and they are coming, and investor-owned utilities are getting them as well, how can we comply, and how can we make sure that the other consumers of that utility don't have to bear all the costs of them coming into the state?
Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, Representative Reardon, I was actually struck through the months of conversation that we had, both the work in the meetings and then work outside of the committee and some side conversations parties we're having pretty actively to try to work through this, that where I would say a lot of the conversation came to was less a question about should we have continued development of renewable energy or not. It was less a question, I think, that in the past we've seen some, is renewable energy good or bad for the state of Oregon? Can we integrate it? I saw fewer of those types of conversations and more conversation about how do we cost effectively deliver renewable energy and how do we meet customer demand. I think one of the things that was a pretty interesting conversation out of it that I think is still some detail to be worked out is that there are customers or potentially new businesses, data centers, some high-tech companies, large energy users who actually have pretty big demand to be able to have more renewable energy and low carbon energy as part of the energy that serves their business. And I think that there is a conversation about where do businesses locate, whose service territory are they on. That conversation does occur, but I think that it was interesting to me and you know, our from renewable portfolio or renewable Northwest project standard or perspective, excuse me, forgetting my R-based acronyms are confusing me today. But from our perspective, we're wanting to promote renewable energy in the state. We don't want to advantage or disadvantage one utility over another. There is a certain amount of competition that occurs within the state to attract new load and new business. And I think as a going forward issue, I think that having more renewable energy is a competitive advantage for the state of Oregon.
I agree with that.
Representative, I have a sneaking suspicion we may have additional comments about cross-jurisdictional competitive implications from subsequent panels, so hold that thought. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted, I really appreciate your use of the word détente. I hadn't heard that before. So, dating yourself. But
makes us feel kind of important up here.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know
summit.
We elevated us.
Box of the 80s.
But... and I appreciate the work that both parties have gone to here to try to reach some sort of rational, reasonable place in the middle, I think, that's good for everybody. But I think it just points out, with regard to the RPS, you know, that was conceived at a point in time, it's very difficult to foresee what the Oregon of the future is going to look like, where economic development is going to occur, what the industries of the future are going to be. So I think it just amplifies the necessity to make sure that this is a dynamic document, if you will, or standard, that we don't, in the interest of trying to abide by some arbitrary percentages established back in 2011, handcuff ourselves going forward, as we're in a competitive marketplace, obviously, for industry and for economic development. And you know, as we go, you know, a lot of what we see coming up down the future is not going to be I-5 or Portland centric investment. You know, the industry of the future could be just as significant in Burns or Baker or Bend and Hood River. So we have to be able to make these kind of modifications as they come to our attention. But I guess, again, getting back to détente, as I recall, regarding our relationship with the Soviet Union, it wasn't a permanent cessation of hostilities, if you will. It was a temporary stand down. So my question, I guess, for Ted, what could be the next bump in the road that could blow this diplomatic arrangement apart and we're back to this kind of a relationship again? Is there anything that you're concerned about looking long term that we might have to keep our eyes out for?
Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson. Well, it's a very good question. And the RPS is a living, breathing law, and it has been amended, you know, several times since 2007. And we did not view this as gutting the RPS or blowing up the RPS. We thought this was a fix to something that was never envisioned in 2007, where these data centers coming in, the massive growth that are coming in, that came in and could create a scenario where, again, a medium-sized utility becomes as large as our biggest investor-owned utilities in the state. So I don't know what the next step is. Again, I think what we found through this task force is that we have a lot in common. You know, various utilities in the state, we're all interested in renewables. And I think what we're trying to find is that if we can work together more collaboratively like we did within this task force rather than go at loggerheads, we can solve these problems. And so there will be problems coming up. I hope they don't come to the sort of the level that we've had before. And again, we can work these things out. And I think we have really established some good relationships through the use of this task force. So we'll have to see, I guess, is the answer. But we're hopeful that we can work through these in a collaborative way.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost forgot what I was going to ask. Such an interesting conversation. I wanted to welcome Representative Smith-Warner, too, and let you know that we're all at your request for any kind of information, updating, et cetera, as are this whole room of experts in here. And thank you both for your work and everybody in the room who was involved in that detente, glasnost, whatever you want to call it. That's the new term, Mark, and or newer term. But with all that aside, a lot of us throw around acronyms, things like that, so I wondered if you could just do like a brief, the unbundled REC, ROCs, whatever we talk about that we toss around, you might not hear in other venues, so.
Representative Bailey and Representative Boone, I do want to say, I'm going to let Varner answer that question, but for the record, I want to reflect that he did want to be referred to as the Soviet Union in this detente.
Mr. Chairman, I think Ted misheard slightly. I think he was characterizing me as Ronald Reagan himself as Mr. Gorbachev, which is funny in a number of different ways. A renewable energy certificate is generated every time a qualifying renewable energy resource generates 1 megawatt hour, 1 megawatt hour of power. So as it's sort of as a wind turbine spits out 1 megawatt hour of energy, paper certificate is, or actually electronic certificate is generated. There are two ways to sell renewable energy. Either what's called a bundled product where you're selling both the renewable energy certificate and the power created from that at the same time, or separately, the power is purchased by one party and the renewable energy certificate is sold separately. There's a stark example in California in their renewable portfolio standard where a wind farm built in Montana was actually physically delivering energy north to Alberta, and the renewable energy certificates were being used for compliance in Southern California. So there's that sort of gives a physical kind of notion of how the power power flows work. There's a different cost to what's called a bundled renewable energy certificate. Depending on where you're at in the country, those can be anywhere from a few dollars to $20 or $30 to have that renewable attribute. Currently, an unbundled renewable energy certificate, and there's a fair amount of surplus of those in the market today. Those are selling anywhere from 70 cents to a dollar. So in Oregon's RPS, there's currently a limit for large utilities of only being able to use 20% unbundled renewable energy certificates. In some limited situations, some utilities are able to use 50% unbundled certificates up till 2020. And it's worth noting for utilities that are in the small category of the RPS who have serve less than 3% of the total load in the state or total electrical demand in the state, they have a 10% compliance obligation, or utilities that serve less than 1.5% of load have a 5% obligation. Now, for utilities in that 5 or 10% category or the small utility category, they are allowed in the status quo to use 100% unbundled renewable energy certificates. So in the compromise that we've worked out here, essentially what would happen is as utility like Umatilla Electric Co-op would move from the 10% category up to the 25% category as their load grows, they both, under the status quo, have delayed implementation. The first actual compliance date or obligation for Umatilla Electric Co-op isn't until 2022, under the projections we have. Did I get that right?
Sounds right.
So we'd be phasing in starting in 2022. They'd still be able to use 100% unbundled renewable energy certificates, and then it would sort of ramp up to 80% or ramp down, excuse me, to 20% unbundled certificates as they move towards the 25% obligation. Was that helpful or unhelpful? Thank you, Representative Bill.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Werner, can you go back briefly to the, I think you said what the cost of the RPS had been across the board to the ratepayers. Can you say that again? And with the period of time over which we've had the experience now.
Sure. Chair Bailey, Representative Benz. It's worth noting that the way that Oregon's RPS works, for the only utilities that have a compliance obligation under the renewable portfolio standard at today, are those that are in that 25% category. The utilities in the 25% category today are serving, meaning they serve more than 3% of electrical load in the state, are PacifiCorp, Portland General Electric, and Eugene Water and Electric Board. According to the PUC, looking at data for PGE and PacifiCorp, I think PGE had roughly about a 1% rate increase as a result of the RPS. Now, this came up in the Senate hearing we had on Wednesday. That isn't to say that rates have only gone up 1%. They've only gone up 1% because of compliance under the RPS. For PacifiCorp, looking at the methodology, I think it was effectively almost no rate increase. And the way that that is calculated is it's the sort of the avoided cost calculation. So if it wasn't for the RPS, what other resources would the utility be buying? And as load is growing and as assets need to be retired, utilities do have to buy new power. And so really what that's calculating is the difference between buying a new, say, gas plant and what the fuel cost of that would be over the long term versus buying a wind farm and what the cost of that would be over the long term.
Right. So one of the reasons, am I correct in assuming that one of the reasons that the green power replacement was just 1% was California's decision to prevent some of the power being generated here from being sold into that market? And if that's true, and I need to know if that's true, then can we anticipate if they change their policy, we would see a change in the cost of this renewable power part of the portfolio?
Representative Bailey, Representative Benz, I actually don't think that it was a result of California. Generally, the way that, before my current role, I did a lot of active lobbying in California and actually worked on the passage of the law that did have some of those restrictions. I think the way that generally we see new projects aren't built until there's a contract to sell that power, with a couple, with a handful of exceptions in the Pacific Northwest. And what really I think more describes what that difference is, and I think Scott Bolton from PacifiCorp will be up in a moment, and I think he can talk about the PacifiCorp experience in a little bit more detail. There are a couple of factors. One is the cost of renewable energy has come down pretty significantly in the last several years. I mean, for instance, the per watt price of solar has dropped from $4.25 in 2007 to about 70 cents today. Wind power has gone from being over $100 megawatt hour to being, we think now you can transact in Oregon for about, Oregon, Washington, for in the low 50s. As well, there's trying to figure out what the cost of natural gas is. So I actually don't believe that that cost has really been a result of California. I think more what we've seen in the Northwest is with California changing their RPS laws to really require more in-state development or delivered and more bundled energy, kind of referencing what I was talking about a moment ago with the concern they had over that Montana project. I think what we see is that there's been a slowdown in the pace of development in the Northwest because there's been less demand for new build for projects in the Northwest. But by and large, but for a handful of projects, the majority of the wind turbines you see today in Oregon are under a long-term power purchase agreement, and there is a buyer for that power. So it isn't necessarily these are merchant or sort of spot market facilities.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Lisa Schwartz and Julie Peacock, please.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson and Vice Chair Boone, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Lisa Schwartz, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and with me is Julie Peacock, Energy Policy Analyst. The department serves as a resource for the Renewable Portfolio Standard Task Force. And specifically, today we're going to share with you results of some of the modeling that we did in support of the task force. First, we're going to show you results for business as usual. In other words, no changes to the current law. Secondly, we'll show you the proposed amendments today from the task force under consideration. And that's, as Mr. Case said, to reduce the cost for utilities today that are considered small under the law, but that are seeing some rapid development, particularly with load centers, and would be transitioning to the large utility category, which would be a higher level of standard that would need to be met under the law. We want to thank all of the utilities in the state, all of whom provided us load forecasts that enabled us to do the analysis you'll see today. And I want to note that the task force has not yet concluded its work. Like any proposal, these amendments could change. Also, of course, we can't speak for the task force or any specific member. We're simply a resource here. And the co-chairs will keep the committee informed about the progress of their work. Before Julie presents the specific modeling results this morning, you've gotten a very good background from Varner and Ted on the issues and the law. I'm going to go pretty quickly through just a few slides to fill things out. So really wanted to emphasize just a few points. Under the law, utilities must deliver a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable resources. And the point here is it's new renewable resources. The law includes several flexibility mechanisms, and really the one that we're focused on here today is the use of unbundled renewable energy certificates. And as Varner said, these certificates are much less expensive. So it's a really easy way to sort of mitigate some of the cost concerns that might be out there. They're really easy to buy and sell. Today, they're really inexpensive, and a utility can bank as many as they want for as long as they want and use them at any time. So it really is quite a good flexibility mechanism that we have. I also wanted to point out the department's role under the law primarily is to certify generating facilities as eligible under the law. So here are some of the specific requirements. You heard, you have these slides. It's sort of a lot to take in, but I think the main point is that large utilities are required to meet that standard of 25% of eligible renewable resources that are new as of the year 2025, and they have some interim standards, one of which has already passed the 5% standard in the year 2011. There's also a standard that they must meet in 2015 of 15% of their load met by eligible resources. And again, the one that you're hearing about mostly is that 25% target out in the year 2025. Large utilities today are Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, and Eugene Water Electric Board. Small utilities must meet a lower standard depending on their specific size, and that's really the percentage of load that they meet relative to everyone else in the state. It's either 5% by the year 2025 or 10% by that year, and there are no interim requirements. So this slide is just a representation that a lot of resources really are covered under the law and are allowed. And here's a breakdown by resource type. The department has certified to date as eligible for the state standard. We included a further breakdown of hydro on the right side, so you can see the relative contribution of each of the three types of hydro that are allowed today under the law. Julie will talk a little bit more about this, but it's the hydro efficiency projects. So these are efficiency improvements to existing dams, low-impact hydro, as well as... what is that third category? Any new projects that are outside of protected areas, new hydro. What I want to point out here simply is that there are a lot of large hydro efficiency projects that are underway by Bonneville Power Administration that primarily the consumer and utilities are receiving. And this does not include all of them. This does include Grand Coulee, but it does not yet include, for example, Bonneville Dam, a very large energy efficiency project at the dam. And there are others forthcoming. So these numbers will increase.
Hi, good morning, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I'm Julie Peacock, an energy policy analyst with the Oregon Department of Energy. And as you've heard from other members of the task force, the department got a request to model two cases, a business as usual and the different proposals brought forth by the task force. Working with utilities statewide, the department used Umatilla Electric Cooperative as its base model to model what changes the proposals would bring in terms of the cost of compliance per year, the share of unbundled and bundled RECs, the share of utility load used to meet compliance, and the amount of RECs. And I know Varner and Ted went over this, but I'll just go over the general proposal. And as you can see, it's up there at the bottom. I know sometimes when people are saying it out loud, it's difficult to hear. But as currently outlined, the proposal will change the time frame in which consumer-owned utilities classified as large are able to use a larger share of unbundled RECs for their compliance. Under current statute, COUs can use 50% unbundled RECs until 2020 to meet compliance. Under the proposal, COUs will be able to use 100% unbundled RECs while at the 5% compliance level, 75% unbundled RECs at the 15 and 20% compliance level, and when they enter the 25% compliance level, the proposal reverts to 20%, which is the same as business as usual. So just some general assumptions we used in doing our model. The analysis assumes Umatilla's native load will grow 2% per year, and a large load of 20 average megawatts will join the utility in 2013, 2014, and 2015. The incremental cost of compliance we used was $48 per megawatt hour. The price of unbundled RECs was $1. This analysis also projects out to 2038. This graph represents the year-by-year cost of business as usual and the proposal, with the green line representing business as usual and the blue line representing the proposal. Both scenarios would begin in 2022 due to the glide path that allows utilities entering the largest group additional time to comply with the law. Based on current statewide load projections, Umatilla would become subject to the standard in 2018. As you can see, under business as usual, the cost curve flattens out in 2028, which is when Umatilla would reach its 4% cost cap. Mm-hmm. Under the proposal, you can see the blue line grows in 2029, which is when Umatilla would enter the 15% compliance level and start using 75% unbundled RECs. In 2033, the utility enters 20% compliance and continues to use 75% unbundled RECs. Then in 2038, they enter 25% compliance and can use 20% unbundled RECs. This is the year the proposal and business as usual are the same, and Umatilla also reaches the cost cap under the proposal. And you can see this is why they meet at the end in 2038. This graph represents the number of RECs retired to meet compliance each year the utility is subject to the standard. Both start in 2022. The divergence occurs in 2028 when, under business as usual, Umatilla reaches the 4% cost cap, and then they meet in 2038 when the proposal and business as usual become the same. The number of RECs generated by the proposal is significantly different given the variance in the cost between bundled and unbundled RECs. So in this analysis, the utility could purchase 48 unbundled RECs for the price of one bundled REC. This graph represents the share of Umatilla's load that will be met with Oregon RPS-eligible resources. Similar to the previous graph, the proposals are essentially the same until 2028, when under business as usual, Umatilla reaches the cost cap. Under the proposal, the utility will meet up to 20% of its load with RPS-eligible renewables in 2032. Then in 2038, when the utility can use 20% unbundled RECs, that drops to 11% of load. Under business as usual, the utility will meet up to 11% of its load with RPS-eligible renewables, and that's in 2038. Perhaps this graph illustrates best the changes that the proposal would bring in the share of bundled and unbundled RECs over the analyzed time frame. After 2038, however, when the proposal and business as usual are the same, the percentage of bundled RECs will increase under the proposal scenario each year beyond 2038. a few observations. This gives consumer-owned utilities a longer period of time to use unbundled RECs. And under the proposal, the total volume of RECs is higher than business as usual, given the relatively lower cost of unbundled RECs. The proposal also extends the time period before which the utility will hit the 4% cost cap from 2028 to 2038. This concludes our testimony, and we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
You're
very
welcome.
Informative. Appreciate the information you put into this PowerPoint and your efforts to help the work group in its task.
Sure.
Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
What effect do you anticipate that natural gas or liquefied natural gas will have on the entire energy scenario in the future, now by 2028?
Representative Whitsitt, Chair Bailey, as a very general question, as a general matter, forecasts are such that natural gas prices are projected to be quite low into the future. So you are seeing, fuel switches, say from coal to gas, naturally as a result of low natural gas prices. For example, with respect to renewable resources, there are a lot of factors here. For one thing, we have seen a technology cost decline for wind and other renewable resources, including solar. So that's one factor, and of course geothermal as well. Another factor is always commodity prices. So natural gas and coal prices are huge factors. Load growth is a factor. And of course the federal incentives are really a big piece. The production tax credit, for example, can represent a third of the project value for renewables. So it's, like any forecast, we have really no idea. We do our best to look out 10, 20 years and look at all these factors, and pretty much the best you can do is run a lot of scenarios with lows and highs and, midpoints. But at this point, if things hold up with low natural gas prices, you'll probably see natural gas continuing to take more of a chunk out of the total energy picture for electricity.
Great. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very interesting. I can you share with us the difference between the cost of the REC on the one hand and that which they would have had to do on the other? We could figure that over time, but obviously going this route is less expensive. And I'm just trying to figure out what it is that, by using this approach, allowed them to avoid. Because there's a difference in the cost of these, of the REC on the one hand that they're buying and replacement power on the other. It's too simple just for me to ask what that difference is. So maybe you can explain it, why this worked for everybody. I mean, I see how it, I see what you did, but How come it works?
I'm sorry, I think I'm confused by the question, Representative Benz.
If the small utility had had to go out and meet the standard, it would have cost a lot of money. Instead, they're allowed to buy RECs, which costs less. Right? Or they wouldn't have done it.
Right.
So my question is, what is that difference? And how did the REC approach work for those who were interested in maintaining the same level playing field?
Right. Representative Benz, members of the committee, I think you might be asking about the incremental cost difference between bundled and unbundled RECs.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
Please. So the... If the bundled REC is the same as what the RPS would have required, but they didn't have to do, then you're stating my question correctly.
Okay. If you'll take a quick look at this chart up here, this is some of our cost assumptions. We actually took information from the PAC IRP. You'll see wind scenario 1 and wind scenario 2, $106.76 per megawatt hour, and then $80.36 per megawatt hour. We compared that to mid-sea market prices from the Avista Integrated Resource Plan, which is Umatilla's purchasing entity, PNGC. They use these prices to sort of forecast out for the utility. The mid-sea market purchase price would be the price that they would pay for just spot market power going forward. We didn't make any sort of assumptions about whether or not they'd be purchasing Tier 2 Bonneville power purchases to meet that load growth.
Please. So where on that list is what they ended up doing? Which one of those types of power is the REC equivalent of?
Sorry, Representative Bentz, it's actually sort of not explicitly stated. What we did was a slight sensitivity analysis. We did a high cost and a low cost, and then we took a mid cost, which would be the middle of the 106 and the $80, and then we found the incremental cost. So the cost difference is the last number there. It's the $48 per megawatt hour from purchasing mid-C power to purchasing the RPS eligible resource with the bundled REC.
So the last line is what Umatilla ends up paying. Is that what they're going to end up paying, as opposed to the, let's say, the, one of the other wind scenario or the mid sea market? I guess you could use what are they going to end up paying as a result of this proposed arrangement?
The result of your analysis, essentially.
But Representative Vance, members of the committee, that's actually a number that we didn't calculate, like the per megawatt hour cost that they will be paying over the life of the 24-year time period. We did not calculate that. But what they will be paying is $1 for the unbundled RECs versus the $48 incremental cost. So essentially, the cost savings comes in when you're purchasing 48 RECs for the price of one bundled REC.
Looking for the total cost difference of business as usual.
Well, I have that number, and we can get back to you with that. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's fine. If I may, there's others that I think are going to talk about this maybe in more detail, so this is a good start. Thank you.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this presentation. So one thing that I'm having trouble understanding is So this is obviously, the task force has been working to find this agreement. But in changing what we're doing as current business as usual, we're changing things. So are we changing any of the outcomes to the RPS? Like, what's the opportunity cost of making this change in terms of what we're doing besides being able to lower the cost?
Representative Jacob Peterson, members of the committee, the opportunity cost essentially, you can look at it from this slide here, is the bundled versus unbundled REC percentage change that will be occurring. And as Varner mentioned, RNP equates that to 12 turbines over the life of this proposal. Another way to look at it is in sheer total number of RECs that will be retired over the 24-year time period that we examined. With the proposal changes, there are actually 4,269,101 RECs that will be retired. Under business as usual, there will be 2,631,116 RECs retired. So you're getting more RECs retired over the 24-year time period that we analyzed, but there's a difference in the type of REC that they are bundled or unbundled.
Okay, follow up?
Please.
So, So for the bundled versus unbundled RECs, I mean, so it has to do with what they're able to do with the RECs. I mean, there's more flexibility with the unbundled RECs versus the bundled RECs.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the analysis. And finally, I'd like to call up Scott Bolton and Jeff Bissonnette, please. Why don't you sit to my right,
Jeff?
Good morning. For the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Many folks know and love us as Pacific Power. We serve about 550,000 customers across the state, mainly in rural communities. We also, through Pacific Corp, operate in five other western states, about 1.8 million customers in total. One of the things, as we entered this RPS task force, that you've been hearing about this morning, and I'm going to say we a lot because after a vigorous numerous rounds of rock, paper, scissors, I'll be presenting pretty much on behalf of Pacific Corp as well as Portland General Electric. My esteemed colleague Marion Haynes will be presenting on the low income weatherization bill you'll hear a little bit later this morning. But the two large investor-owned utilities serving the state, which is about 70 to 75% of the state's load or customers, depending on how you measure, worked together entering this task force and developed a number of principles that we laid out early in this process, and I think kind of helped guide and provide some boundaries around the discussion. The principles were to preserve the efficacy of the RPS, including established consumer protections. And I think you heard about some of those consumer protections from Director Schwartz on the previous panel. We also wanted to ensure that the RPS continues to apply statewide in an equitable manner. As you've also heard, every utility in the state has some obligation under the RPS. Those levels of obligation really are based on the impact of that utility on the state, based on the amount of customers, the amount of load that you serve. But everybody does something, but it's flexible in recognizing that not every utility is similarly situated. So equitable, not equal. And allow all Oregon utilities to offer the same services and products that their customers want. That's an important concept as well, that nobody is limited or constrained in their ability to respond to their customers. And finally, changes to the RPS should not advantage some utilities at the expense of others. I think a lot of the discussion this morning has been around how to accommodate smaller consumer-owned utilities as they grow into a larger obligation under the standard. And I would say is a large component of this broader deal that you're seeing different pieces of this morning. There's been discussion of statewide ballot measures. There's been discussion of how do you deal with and integrate more unbundled RECs into customer or utility compliance. There's also the idea of really the third principle, which that we laid out, which is how do we serve customers in the way that they want to be served. And so in that regard, and I think Mr. Seaman touched on this quite well earlier, is that the RPS, you know, really, it, you know, to a utility, the RPS is a procurement standard. It establishes a methodology, a preference by the state on how we go out and get new energy resources. Kind of technical. But what the RPS has become since passage into law in 2007 has been an economic development tool for the state. And you see that in the amount of renewable energy resources that have been developed, whether it's wind turbines in the gorge or solar installations in southern Oregon, or even the amount of investment that's gone into existing hydro to upgrade and improve the efficiency of the hydro resource that the state already enjoys. A lot of that has been driven, a lot of capital has been invested as a result of this policy. What we're also starting to see emerge is the RPS as an economic development tool beyond just generation resources, but in that availability of a certain type of green product, of green electricity, to be able to serve new customers, whether they're data centers or high-tech companies or others that through their, to respond to their customers' values, want to provide a different type of service or product, want to be provided. And so as another component, another leg of this stool that brings us here, it's not just the ballot measure, it's not just about unbundled RECs, it's also about how do we get that additionality, how do we make the RPS or the state's renewable policies grow as a flexible living document, is how do we make sure that we have some flexibility for all utilities to participate and provide those kinds of services that customers are now demanding. And so, again, because we write things down or principal players, we put together Portland General Electric and Pacific Power some ideas, some framework of what that would look like. And so it really is, how do you allow more renewable energy to be available on a voluntary basis for those customers who want to purchase greener power? And ensuring that we have the very core principle of maintaining the idea of cost causation. So we want to make sure that those who do pay for these kinds of services and products do so without impact to those other customers who don't want to pay. So make sure that we're not cost shifting, and frankly that we're not benefit shifting, because those who pay for greener energy do so because they value that and should be able to get what they pay for. And we wanted to make sure that as we enter into this new world where customers don't just want cheap anymore, they want specific types of energy, that the Public Utility Commission maintains a really robust process to really figure out how to do this in a fair and in a fair way that preserves and frankly expands consumer choice and has the ability to oversee the development of a marketplace, because we don't want unintended consequences. We want to make sure that as we enter into providing these types of services, that we do so in a way that promotes more renewable energy development, that adds more resources, more opportunities, particularly for rural Oregon, not just on the development side, but also in attracting the types of customers that we want to see come to the state, those kinds of businesses that want to invest here, that are looking at Oregon against other states that may be able to offer the kinds of products that we currently are blocked from doing. So that's another piece of this. That's something that there's still a lot of work happening behind the scenes to try to arrive at some consensus at. But I want to make sure that this committee was updated on all the components of the current discussion. And again, for us, at the end of the day, this is really about how do we, this isn't necessarily how do we enrich the utility or the shareholders. It really is how do we respond to the customers who want to be served in ways that they want to be served. And for us, for Pacific Power in particular, this is about how do we make sure that no community, especially rural communities, are left behind in this discussion. And I'll conclude there and take your questions when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you. I suspect Mr. Bissonnette's going to have a slightly different line, so why don't we take questions from Mr. Bolton now. We can have additional follow-up questions after Mr. Bissonnette has a chance to speak. I do have a quick question. I want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly the aspect that you are talking about, and I think in parlance it's been referred to as green tariff, is a permissive change for the Public Utility Commission. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The concept that we have provided to the RPS task force and to our stakeholders is we don't have all the answers, because we have customers that have slightly different, in some cases more than slightly different, views on what a green tariff or this additional a green energy product would look like. And so we really feel like in order to protect consumer interests, in order to protect the idea of a vibrant, robust marketplace, that really the Public Utility Commission is the absolute best venue to have this discussion. Right now, though, there is a statutory barrier to even really allowing the commission to come up with solutions for customers at this point. And so what we've asked is to simply remove that barrier, but entrust the PUC through its process and through engagement of all the affected parties to be able to develop over time what this looks like.
Additional questions for Mr. Bolton, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, Scott, share with us the comparative, I'm not quite sure what standard for you to use here, but that which you're suggesting, the green tariff, as compared to that which Umatilla wants, I was trying to get at earlier what it was that Umatilla was being able to avoid in paying by virtue of the arrangement it's trying to work out, which was explained to us. I could then compare it to what you're sharing with us now, just on a dollar basis.
Sure.
I'm not sure that works. So maybe you can share with me, other than the word green appearing in both someplace, what is it that makes one offset the other?
It's not easy being green.
Right. Yeah.
I guess what I would say is it's a little bit of apples and oranges, and maybe to answer the UEC situation or what it means to comply with unbundled RECs versus other alternatives, I guess what I would say is that the majority of consumer-owned utilities in the state have, I would say, virtually zero incremental or zero cost basis that they're starting from towards the RPS because of those efficiency upgrades that are allowable that Ms. Schwartz talked about from the Bonneville Power Administration through their hydropower contracts. Most of the consumer-owned utilities in the state are receiving, frankly, bundled RECs as part of those contracts and are able to apply those towards their compliance obligation. Where you have larger consumer-owned utilities who are moving into a larger standard, their incremental costs are actually quite high because their base cost is basically baked into their contracts that they're already receiving. And so that next increment can be quite expensive. Unbundled RECs, right now the market says they're about $1 a REC, is a pretty low-cost alternative. And I think where the department was trying to get at is that even though you can go out and buy a whole bunch of unbundled RECs, you still need power. You still need to have energy to supply your customers. So just a bunch of certificates saying there's some green power out there somewhere doesn't go far enough because you have to still rebundle, if you will, that compliance instrument with whatever your next incremental resource is going to be. And for a co-op the size of Umatilla, they're probably going to go to the mid-Columbia generators, so mid-sea hydro operators for additional power. That could also come from natural gas, depending on what the market's showing. But I think most consumer-owned utilities in the region are comfortable working through a third party or through Bonneville to get additional hydro. So it's going to be whatever that underlying market contract is for the power, plus a buck for the REC. For us, when we're talking about green tariff, we're talking about a different product because we're talking about beyond what our system service is and our cost, what a customer who's fairly large and sophisticated and has specific energy needs as far as carbon content or the type of technology that serves them, what they want to see procured for them in the marketplace. And so my guess is that should this proceed and should we be able to be allowed to provide this type of service to our customers, we will be going out into the marketplace and based on what that customer is telling us of what they are willing to pay, because, they're still businesses and, they're going to want to get green power, but they're going to want it priced as competitively as they can find. We'll be going out into the marketplace and soliciting, okay, what's wind costing from this developer, what's solar costing from that developer, and trying to provide options for them to be able to be served in the way that they want to be served. And there's no knowing what that cost is going to be until we get out into that marketplace.
Thank you for that answer.
You bet.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, you've kind of touched in a general sense, I think, on going forward some additional flexibility that you and your energy producing colleagues would like, energy selling colleagues would like to have. Could you get more specific about potential either existing customer or new customer wishes that you're currently not able to fulfill and what you might be asking us to give you that flexibility for in the near future?
You bet, Representative. I guess to put it in kind of a simple analogy, right now, under Oregon's regulatory rubric, utilities such as Portland General Electric and Pacific Power basically offer vanilla ice cream. We serve our customers with basically our system power and whatever the content of that system power is. Under the RPS, over time, we're seeing a greater portion of that system power as qualifying renewable energy. But what we're talking about are really those customers that are already approaching us, large customers who are investing in our communities that want to see chocolate. They want to see a different flavor of system power than what we offer as general service. And so that's really what we're talking about is their ability to work with their utility to get to a type of energy service or energy product that they feel matches their values and what they want to purchase. That's effectively what we're talking about. And I would also add to that, it's not just the existing customers that we have that are approaching us for these types of services. We're also aware of where other businesses have looked at locating in Oregon and have frankly passed on Oregon and gone to other jurisdictions, other states, as a result of the difficulty in being able to get chocolate ice cream from their local utility.
And these are customers that are willing to pay a premium for that chocolate ice cream over and above what the cost of vanilla has been and would continue to be. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I can't underscore enough that not only is it Oregon's current public policy, but also what we seek to maintain, that this really is voluntary and additional. This is what those customers are willing to pay for and bear the risk of, the cost and the risk of, and not shift any of their resource choices onto other customers.
And just then one more follow-up, just to clarify that this is a, having this ability could, in fact, have a positive impact on the economy in various areas of your service and so forth by either allowing or encouraging expansion of existing manufacturing, whatever facilities, but also the siting of new businesses to Oregon. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Johnson. That's frankly our motivation here. Sitting here today, not knowing what the PUC process would ultimately deliver, I honestly don't think that this is a big new revenue business for the investor-owned utilities. What we really see this as is facilitating this development and, frankly, growing the economic base and opportunity for the communities that we serve.
Thank you.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So Pacific Power operates in several states. Do you have green tariffs in other states? And if so, how are they working? Like, how does it work in other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vega Peterson, Pacific Power serves in three states, Oregon, Washington, California. As Pacific Corp, we also serve in Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. And under MidAmerican, our parent company, we serve in 11 states. And in fact, the newest company to join our family of businesses is NV Energy, which is Nevada's utility that serves about 90% of Nevada. Nevada just completed their first green tariff late last year and is working with a development for Apple for a data center there located outside of Las Vegas. And frankly, that was a site that, you know, we have an Apple site here in Central Oregon as well. But expansion here was also part of what they were looking at a few years ago before they decided to go to Nevada. So we've seen how these kinds of policies can drive investment decisions. Too soon yet to tell how it's working in Nevada, but they're underway making that investment. In Utah, very different state politically than Oregon. In Utah, legislation was passed a few years ago to allow this type of relationship with large customers and their utilities. Hasn't worked as well as I think it could, frankly, because there isn't as robust of a market for renewable energy there, not as much choice for resource supply as there is here in the Northwest. But certainly we're starting to see a growing interest there. And then in some of the states like Iowa, there's a very robust market. One of the interesting facets to this debate is that, in most of our other states, if we went to legislatures, if we went to our stakeholders and said, we want to find a way to increase the amount of renewable energy that our customers are willing to step up and pay for, we would get a lot of encouragement. People would say, how can we help you do that? And that's what we're hoping to achieve here as well. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Bissonnette, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers. I want to hit on two topics that have been under discussion today and then sort of throw in a third that's related to the topic we've just been talking about. The first issue I did want to weigh in with Cubs, thanks to Marty Hoffman, the governor's energy advisor, and Representative Greg Smith for their leadership on the task force. I think that it was kind of tough sledding at first because those of us who worked on creation of the RPS back in 2007, I think we did create a pretty dynamic statute, and there was a lot of tools to help utilities in any number of circumstances manage their compliance with the law. We've said time and again that we never created a law to play gotcha with the utility. We really did want to be able to have utilities find compliance with the law relatively easy. And so it took a long time to really kind of figure out a problem statement or what we were finally trying to solve. And I think the two things that broke that logjam, as Ted Case said earlier, was some analysis of the actual impacts that different proposals were having that the Department of Energy did. And so we could really see, you know, numbers and graphs and charts and that sort of thing. And those tend to help bring some reality to conversations. And then I think there was a kind of a price point, if you will, that Umatilla in particular really wanted to hit, and having that understanding gave us sort of a target to shoot for. And so I think that those two pieces really helped to solidify what we were trying to do and how to wrestle an agreement into place. And so I'm hopeful as we finish kind of working out the details that we'll be in front of you during the session with a solution that will bring some peace to the valley, not to use any big foreign policy words, you know, on this issue for a while. And I think that'll be a welcome change for us and for you. Secondly, I want to kind of wade into a little bit of what Mr. Bolton was talking about. And he said, you know, three things, two of which I disagree with, one of which I agree with. The first thing that he said that I agree with is that the issue dealing with Umatilla and the issue of a green tariff are really apples and oranges. I mean, he's talking about a voluntary product for industrial customers. And that's fine, but voluntary programs don't qualify for compliance with the RPS. They don't on the residential and commercial products that are offered to customers, and I don't believe they would on the industrial side as well. That's not to say that coming up with a way of having the utility offer an industrial voluntary green tariff or green product to industrial customers is a bad thing. I think it could be a good thing. But that leads me to the places where I disagree. One is that he said it was a regulatory framework. It's not a regulatory framework. It's a statutory framework. To be fair, he did say later it was the policy of the state, but it's statutory, legislative policy of the state for direct access. Utilities can't compete for the business of industrial customers for sort of specialized products. They can only offer vanilla ice cream. And if we want to change that policy of the state, that's terrific. I don't think there's anybody that opposes having that discussion. I don't think there's anybody that opposes finding a solution to say, does the policy of direct access need changing? But that's a big discussion, and it's not you know, it's not one that we decide really in a week. We're kind of here talking about that issue because we were able to solve the issues for Umatilla Electric Co-op. A couple of weeks ago, that didn't really look possible. You know, I would, but now we're trying to wrestle with an issue in terms of green tariffs that require definitely require a lot more discussion and definitely require more parties than are around the negotiating table for the RPS issue that we came to the table to solve. So again, to be very clear, want to have that discussion, want to figure out if there are changes that need to be made in the direct access policy that the state has. But this direct access policy and the RPS policy are very separate and have a different set of players around the table. And so that's the concern with having it as a part of the RPS discussion. Thirdly, there's another issue, and whenever you talk about renewables, you're talking about clean energy, and you're talking about ways to clean the clean the energy mix. And one of the cheapest ways to do that is through energy efficiency. And the utilities are fond of talking about the hard stuff they have that are keeping them from offering sort of specially designed boutique products for industrial customers that want cleaner energy. But they haven't been talking about the hard stop that we have in making additional investments in energy efficiency in the industrial sector. In Senate Bill 838, the bill that created the RPS also created the mechanism to go after more energy efficiency in both the residential and the commercial sectors, and we left the industrial sector out in the hopes that we would, you know, they were already opposed to the RPS at the time, and our hope was we would reduce their ire on this bill. That didn't happen, but they got left out of the ability to make additional energy efficiency investments. And so if we are going to go ahead and figure out ways to acquire more renewable energy, which is terrific, we though at the same time really need to talk about how to make sure that we are acquiring all low cost, least cost resources in terms of conservation in the same sector. And again, that requires a larger discussion, a longer discussion, and because it's a more complex topic than we can probably cover in the week that we have. And we've been given a deadline by Representative Smith to try and come up with something by high noon next Thursday. And not to say it's impossible, but it's difficult. And, you know, if we had our druthers, we would separate the conversations from about the RPS, let the solution that we've found move ahead, and then have the longer discussion that we need around how best to serve industrial customers, and if changes are needed in direct access policy to really to let that continue and to bring solutions back to you in 2015 if they're needed. I'll stop there and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bissonnette. We just saw some very nice pie charts from the Oregon Department of Energy. Perhaps this question is unfair, but if you could draw a pie chart for us on your objections to the previous testimony, what are we talking about in terms of process versus policy? It sounds like I'm hearing more of a process argument than
it's
a policy argument.
It's process that's directly driven by policy. The policy of direct access took 3 years to develop and has been in place for a dozen years. That doesn't mean it's sacrosanct. It doesn't mean that it can't be changed, but it involves a broader set of industrial customers than I understand are approaching the utilities. It involves energy service suppliers, which are the independent power producers that are out on the market and have built business models, are building business models to meet this sector. It requires, I think, more discussion from both the regulators and the state policy folks to say, what does this really mean? This is a policy that was woven together over a number of years and has been in place for a number of years. And I think that if we start pulling strands, other strands start to react, and you know, we could be faced with a bunch of unintended consequences. So is it a process question? Absolutely, but the process questions are really driven by the fact that this is a pretty complex policy, and if we're just to remove the hard stop, well, the hard stop right now is the policy of the state, and again, happy to talk about changing that, but you don't change that and hope for the best, because I don't think that does justice to the number of people that have a stake in the policy of direct access.
Representative Rudin?
It sounds like you're talking about ways to there are two good ways to address industrial needs, if I'm hearing this correctly. So we could do some green tariffs, and we could do energy efficiency. Both sound like they're be a positive move in cleaning up our environment. But are you saying that you need to have those conversations at one time? Is that what I'm understanding? Or?
I think so, Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon. I think that to have a conversation about how to have higher cost products out there and offered to customers without talking about how to acquire the least cost resource in the form of energy efficiency, and to be able to say that we're willing to leave those costs on the table, which will then possibly lead to not meeting goals that are set in the integrated resource plans, could mean requiring investment in additional, more expensive energy generation, and then that would mean everybody's bills go up. And that's something that you know, I think that we do a disservice to all the customers. We do a disservice to the system by not having that conversation in coordination.
May I respond to that question as well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Representative Reardon. You raise a really interesting question, and there's really more at stake, and frankly, a bigger participation by customers in these energy choices than what we as utilities or folks who are stakeholders in regulatory processes have influence on. Ultimately, these are decisions by consumers and customers themselves. And it plays out at every level. I mean, right now we're talking about industrial, larger customers who choose to buy resources that are either available or will be built for them in the renewable energy marketplace, because that's what they want. If they want to purchase and invest in energy efficiency in their buildings, they have the freedom to do that as well. Just as on the small residential side, we see customers who invest in solar panels on their roof. That's a pretty expensive choice, but that's their choice. They could probably get more energy savings with a caulk and gun and replacing their windows and doors and putting more insulation in their attic. But you know, as a public policy, we don't require them to do all of those energy efficiency measures before they're allowed to make a consumer choice to put solar panels on their roof or to put a small wind turbine in their backyard if their neighbors are okay with that. So, I mean, I just want to pull back and say that this discussion, while it does implicate the state's public policy choices, all that's being requested here is to remove a legal barrier that's been identified so that we can have this robust process. I mean, how many stakeholders, how many interests come before you as a policymaking body begging for more process? And that's really what we're asking for here, is to put this in the hands of the experts of our regulators with a very inclusive process that includes everybody from the actual industrial customers themselves, who are split. Some who just want the cheapest possible energy possible because that is a raw commodity cost that impacts their competitiveness on a global market, and also those larger customers who have a vision for how they want to be served because that's what their customers really want to see, as well as the residential customer advocates who, you know, obviously have a stake in this and want to make sure that whatever decisions get made in one rate class don't get splashed over and have unintended consequences for the rest of customers. And that's really what we're talking about here, is how do we have that conversation, but have that conversation in a way that empowers action at the end of the day.
Some energy.
Thank you.
Maritimes.
Thank you.
I don't want to turn this into a debate back and forth, and we are significantly over time for this particular portion. So unless there's a very short addition to your previous testimony, I'd like to just end this here.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would say is that the choice is there. The only difference from Mr. Bolton's point is that we do not put an artificial cap on the residential side the way we have on the industrial side to make the choices for investment.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, gentlemen, we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the informational hearing on renewable portfolio standard and open an informational hearing on LC 51 relating to facilitation of financing for energy improvements by local governments. Colleagues, you have this LC in your packet. This has been introduced now as a committee bill. I'd like to call up Lisa Alboff and John Talaska to come forward. Great, and if you could introduce this concept to us and what we're taking a look at here and why we're taking a look at it, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Happy to. Good morning, and thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is John Talaska. I'm the Economic Development Director at Multnomah County. I'm here today to talk about LC 51, and it relates to Oregon's PACE legislation. And let me just dive right in. ORS 223.396 allows local governments to support energy efficiency investments in the residential, commercial, and industrial sectors through a tool known as Property Assessed Clean Energy, or PACE. LC 51 allows local governments to partner with private lenders in providing this financing. So what PACE does is PACE addresses the financing barrier to obtaining energy efficiency of investments by allowing a local government to set up a financing program that is tailored directly to financing energy efficiency investments. Specifically, it allows the local government to develop a loan payment program for energy efficiency improvements that allows for the loan payments to be collected as assessments, which are secured by a lien on the property, and allows the payments to be spread out over a very long period of time. This mechanism provides near certainty that there will be repayment for the loan, and by spreading it out over time, it strengthens the business proposition for a building owner to make improvements to their property. So to give you a simple illustration, if a building owner wanted to invest in, say, chillers and boilers to improve the HVAC system on their building, and it cost $500,000, if the energy savings that they got from that were, say, $800,000 over the life of that measure, well, that would be a good investment. If, however, they could only finance it with a conventional 5-year loan, and that $800,000 is spread out over a 12-year period, well, that starts to create cash flow issues for the building owner, because now you're not matching up the energy savings with the loan payments. And so then the building owner is stuck with, well, to make those loan payments, I've got to come out of cash on hand. And for building owners, that's prime. And so then it's a matter of tying up cash that could be used for other things when you have savings that just don't match up with the time period. And so the longer repayment from PACE financing allows you to make a better match there. It allows you to spread out the time period for the loan repayment so that they better match up with energy savings. And so it leads to businesses being able to take advantage of what are actually good business decisions. And it just cures the cash flow problem. To our knowledge, however, a PACE program in Oregon hasn't been implemented yet. 30 other states have enacted PACE legislation. There have been $56 million in PACE financing has been used to date, or through 2013, according to the organization PACE Now. And there are somewhere north of $200 million in projects that are lined up to be funded and to go forward. Multnomah County has been looking at developing a PACE program, and in 2012, we commissioned a study to look at what might a PACE program look like, what does the market look like, and the study concluded that in the county there about 12% of commercial buildings are good candidates for a PACE, for PACE financing for energy efficiency improvements, and in Multnomah County that equates to about 1,000 buildings. And if all those good candidates were to undertake those improvements, that would generate $40 million of additional economic activity in the county, provide 200 person years of employment, so the equivalent of 200 people employed for a year, and save building owners and tenants somewhere north of $70 million in energy costs. So, not surprisingly, given these results, we push forward at the county on developing a PACE program. And unfortunately, along the way, we encountered a significant barrier. The barrier being that the Oregon's PACE statute requires that any PACE funds that are lent out come from, must be lent out by the county and must come from one of two sources, either a revenue bond issued by the county or a loan that the county gets from the state of Oregon through the SELP program that they go to the Department of Energy for. And for us, that statutory restriction impacts the ability of us to be able to develop a PACE program because it gets in the way of the fundamental purpose of PACE, which is to enable property owners to make investments in their property and spread out those payments over time that save themselves and their tenants more money. The first restriction that we encounter is that the fundamental thing that the statute requires us to do by requiring this to be public money is that if it's got to come from a revenue bond or from a SELP loan, we're fundamentally going out borrowing money at one rate, lending it at another rate, having to build in margin to cover the underwriting costs, loan servicing costs. It starts to look a lot more like what a bank does, and we're not a bank. That's not something that we have expertise in. That's what banks do. And second, and perhaps more importantly, it leaves the private sector out entirely. There simply isn't a role for them if it's public funds and we have to be providing the loans and with public money. There just isn't a role for public financing to come in, for private financing. And that really cuts out a lot of the market and folks who do provide financing and know how to do this. And it doesn't enable us to develop a robust program. And so with that, I'm now going to turn it over to Lisa Abloff from the Portland Development Commission, because they've been looking a lot at national programs that have had success doing public-private partnerships, and she can talk about that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bailey and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity for us to be here today to speak to you. For the record, I'm Lisa Abloff. I'm a Central City Manager with the Portland Development Commission. And as the city's economic development and redevelopment agency, we were invited by Multnomah County early on as they were starting their analysis to discuss the possibility of a PACE program in helping to spur economic opportunity as well as property redevelopment in the Portland market, and clearly that aligns directly with PDC's mission. Building on the county's analysis, in the summer of 2012, once they had finished their economic impact and opportunity assessment, we initiated a more detailed look at PACE to really understand what's happening on a national level, to understand what the Portland market potential would be, and to take a deeper dive into what the synergy of a PACE program could be with PDC's existing activities in neighborhood revitalization, working day-to-day with property owners, business owners, and the lending community, and in supporting the growth of our clean tech economy. We reached out to peers, specifically in the Washington, D.C. market, as well as the Connecticut market, both of whom have initiated PACE programs in the past 5 years and are starting to see uptake of those programs. The two programs have followed similar paths, involving one, launching an upfront program design; two, entering into a partnership with an outside administrator who's responsible then for kind of lead and customer generation, underwriting, and contractor training; and three, last but not least, implementing a program that's built on an open financing market with local property owners and lenders, and this allows for owner-arranged financing as opposed to how John has described the Oregon State legislation acts today, where property assessment securitizes the debt, but the public entity is not necessarily the source of that debt. In speaking with Connecticut, they informed us that they actually set out intentionally to create capital, private capital involvement in the program and engage providers directly with private building owners in energy retrofit rather than having the public carry a significant role of a go-between between property owners and the private lending community in an effort to build a more sustainable program and financing model. In 2000, they established the Connecticut Clean Energy and Investment Authority, or CEFIA, which coordinates the investment and the delivery of ratepayer, taxpayer, and private capital into the market and into energy and clean energy projects. Locally, as we work with various property owners, developers, and lenders, we tested those projects that could possibly benefit from a PACE program, and we heard similar feedback to how Connecticut had set up their own program regarding an open market structure being more compelling and a more sustainable model for a program to take. From a property owner point of view, an open market structure allows them to work with their day-to-day lenders and work within known and trusted relationships with their own banks. From a lender point of view, an open market allows them to augment services to their existing clients and or to solicit new clients based on new available services, i.e. they have a new product to offer. In summary, our national review indicated an open market model similar to that used by Connecticut best leverages key market challenges and coordinates the right people at the right time to make the value proposition of retrofits more compelling for an open market for investors and property owners. The changes that are proposed to LC 51 would allow local governments in Oregon to establish similar PACE programs that we've seen resonate nationwide.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I want to make sure that I understand just a few points before we go to questions. This PACE program is already on the books for Oregon. This particular bill, which I am now informed is now House Bill 4041, so now that's been announced. This particular bill takes what is a voluntary program and simply opens it up so that we don't have to use just public capital. We can facilitate private capital with this program. And am I also correct that this is something that could be used by any local government jurisdiction? It just so happens that you both represent local governments that are interested in moving forward on it at this time. Is that, am I understanding all that correctly?
Chair Bailey, yes, you've got that all right. It's a voluntary program. Anyone can do it. Any local government can do it. It's a program that already, it exists, and this is just making one small tweak to it to open up the source of funds so that it doesn't just have to be public money, that it can be private money also and maintain banking relationships rather than having local governments get in the middle of that.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Could you describe or define the term facilitate? When you talk about a local government facilitating, what do you mean by that?
Doesn't matter. The purpose of any sort of change would be to allow the local government to set up the program that in such a way so that a private lender that makes the loan receives the same security position as the local government would have, such that and it's for the same kind of loan. So it can only be for a loan prescribed in the statute, so for an energy efficiency loan. And that by making this loan, the fact that it's coming from a private lender doesn't change the security of that loan. So I feel like maybe I'm spinning in circles, but let me try it a different way. Currently, if a bank were to make a loan, let's just say you go to your bank and you want an energy efficiency loan, the reason that they'd be hesitant to make it or might make it over a shorter period of time is because it's going to be secured. If it's secured at all, it's going to be well down on the list. And the question of whether they get repaid might not match up with, you know, the energy savings, so that's kind of tough. And so they look at it as, how good is this loan? PACE loans are good loans because there you know you can get repaid, so it allows us to take the PACE repayment mechanism or guarantee of that and put that onto this particular loan, irrespective of the fact of where it's coming from. And so facilitation just means to provide that repayment certainty to a private lender who's making the same loan.
Representative Whitsett and Chair Bailey, from having talked with folks nationally, they facilitate the program by sponsoring the program that's available, and then they hire an administrator. So they are not in day-to-day contact. I'm assuming you were asking under the scenario of an open market.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not in day-to-day administration of the program. They are facilitating by making possible property assessment tool, and then the program is usually administered by a third party. So it's literally making available a tool that allows for a property assessment to happen as a repayment mechanism. They are not facilitating in any sort of day-to-day manner. Is that underlying the...
Yes. So would you grow county government a little bit then by doing this? Would you have to hire someone at the county level to do this? And is the county guaranteeing it in any way?
Ah, I see. Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsett. If anything, I would say it's the opposite, that by enabling private lenders to do this, the county's role, or whatever local government is doing it, would become smaller, because we would be less engaged, because now it's the private lender that's making the money. It's not us dealing with necessarily the repayment and the accounting for and the servicing of the loan. That's whatever lender to the building owner is doing it. So to the extent that there is any additional staffing needed related to developing a program, it would certainly be much less staffing having a private lender do it.
And conventionally, the administrator is actually financed off of origination fees and interest. It's self-financing.
Okay. I was wondering where the money came from. Thanks.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you both very much for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And with that, we'll close the informational hearing on LC 51. / HB 4041 and open an informational hearing on LC 215 low income weatherization. And welcome also Representative Widener. Better late than ever.
Sorry for the delay, but had to be at the hospital this morning. So.
Oh gosh, well, we hope everything's
worked
okay.
Very positive.
I'd like to call forward Ryan Fisher, Marion Haynes, and Jeff Bissonette, please. Whoever would like to start may start.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide association of community action agencies. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify briefly today. Quickly, community action agencies, there are 18 community action agencies in the state. They cover every county. They provide services to Oregonians with low incomes around housing needs, but also around energy bill payment assistance and weatherization services for homes. We are here today to talk about a legislative concept that was submitted as we were looking at some ways that we could try to make some improvements to this program. At this point, we wanted to let this committee know that from our perspective, this legislation is still premature. These ideas that are in the LC were submitted in order to meet a legislative deadline, so we're not faulting anyone, but the Housing and Community Services Agency, which currently oversees these programs, is undergoing a major restructure exercise. And those recommendations will be delivered in February, and those changes will be made in 2015. without knowing the direction that those are going to go, it's impossible for us to know which direction this legislation should go. We have come to many points of consensus with the utilities and with the Citizens Utility Board about how we can make improvements to these programs, but there are some issues around governance and alignment of the ratepayer-funded programs with the federally funded programs that still remain, and those issues are inextricably linked to the changes going on at Housing and Community Services. Our role as Community Action Partnership of Oregon is to advocate for program changes that are in the best interest of Oregonians with low incomes, the clients that we serve. And we know that there are improvements to be made. We've come to agreement on some of those points, but we just don't have enough information in 2014 to craft a bill that we feel will best serve our clients. So we look forward to moving a bill with shared objectives at a later time. Probably 2015 would be our expectation.
Okay. Where would I like to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Here, basically, just to say that our interest in this legislation stems from being very disappointed with the Department of Housing and Community Services in managing these programs over the last 10 years. And we have a very high interest in seeing something done. I mean, we have a model on the gas side where the utilities manage the programs with the oversight of the Public Utility Commission, and that experience really kind of formed the basis for you know, a possible direction that we wanted to see. But I made a commitment to the chair and to the committee administrator prior to the committee to keep my my remarks short, and so I'll do that. But I'll just say that from our perspective, there is a change that needs to be made. We would like to see it sooner rather than later, but as Mr. Fisher said, we have a lot of agreement that we have reached, and that we are prepared to continue those discussions, and hopefully we'll come to some agreement soon. Thanks.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I'm with Portland General Electric. As Scott Bolton from PacifiCorp mentioned earlier, we're sort of tag teaming these two hearings, so I'm representing our discussions that PacifiCorp has been in as well. We've been meeting as a group since about July, talking about these issues related to two low-income programs, low-income bill assistance and low-income weatherization. There are both customer-funded programs for bill assistance and weatherization and federal dollars that flow through the state for bill assistance and weatherization. Largely, the conversation that we have had has focused on the consumer-funded programs and making those work both for the low-income customers of ours that they're serving, as well as all the customers that actually help fund these programs. I agree, we have had a number of points of consensus that have come together. We, you know, initially identified some guiding principles that we would all try to achieve during these conversations related to minimizing costs and gaining efficiencies. We think that there are some real improvements to these programs and the administration of these programs that we can achieve that will really in turn maximize the amount of funds that can flow through to serve the folks that most need it. Also providing, you know, good quality customer service and doing that through the existing network of community action agencies in our service territories and really not making any fundamental to the changes to the current program delivery as far as making sure that eligibility requirements and things like that remain consistent so that there stays alignment with the federal funds, which I think is one of the issues that my colleague Ryan here has raised. So there is precedent for this. There is a model on the natural gas side. We think
It's eminently achievable to ensure alignment and that those things continue to go forward. Our preference is to have something that we can move forward with in 14. There's potentially some bridge mechanisms that we can look at to address this so we don't get out in front, but can do some things now to begin this shift. I'd ask perhaps that, you know, we can continue to work with the chair and legislative council on ways that we might do that from a technical perspective. We haven't figured that out. But within the context of this bill, perhaps there is still something that we can identify to help move this forward in 2014. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Over here, if you're... Yeah, Representative Woodson.
Could you tell me total how much in funds comes through these two programs, federal and through the utilities, and the number of people served per year?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have that information off the top of my head, but that information is available, and I'd be happy to provide that to you and the committee.
Mr. Chair, I can just say real quickly in round numbers, in terms of the residential ratepayer side, it's probably somewhere around $7 or $8 million in weatherization, and currently the level of energy assistance through ratepayer funding is $20 million.
20 per year.
Yes. And then in terms of service delivery items, that would come from the caps.
Okay, and we don't know how many people. You don't have any.
That's right. Okay. So the service delivery would have to come from the agencies.
Okay. Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, Community Action Partnership of Oregon annually releases something called an energy snapshot, which contains exactly that sort of information. And I have last year's energy snapshot, and I believe I just heard the other day that this year's energy snapshot is getting close to being completed. And so that would be a great source of information for all those questions.
It sounds to me like there's agreement that there's a need to protect these weatherization funds, and that especially on the state-originated funds, that there is some consensus here that the challenge comes in around how we deal with federal weatherization funds for low income and the added complexity of the overlapping structural change at housing that complicates how and where we direct these funds and where they end up. Is that a fair summation of where you three are?
I think it's an excellent summation of where it is. So, yeah, I think it's right.
Chair Bailey, the only addition I would make is there are, in addition to the structural and the alignment that you mentioned, I would add governance. There are still some questions because we're talking about changing the administrative models, and so that would require some change in governance. And we've had some things that we were in line on, but others that were not, and that's one loose end that still is out there.
So my perception then is that the disagreement tends to be a little bit more over timing of when those entities are going to become, those structural and governance elements are going to become clear and known. So I guess I would say for this committee, my hope is that we can not close the door on this, that we can keep this discussion open. We may have additional discussion open on it in the session. However, it sounds like some of those timing issues may be challenging in the short run. So I wanted to at least get this on the committee's radar screen as something that's being worked on, and we'll see if it surfaces again in 2014, but I would like to keep the door open to that.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can ask the group if it's appropriate at the time during our committee days, the rest of the interim. They could come in and report on your progress or not, or what your intentions are.
Your folks would be happy to keep the committee informed, and appreciate your work on this. I know it's complex, and it's especially complex when we're dealing with something that I think everybody agrees needs to happen sooner rather than later. It's just an issue of can we put the pieces of the puzzle in place in the timing that's allotted to us. So appreciate your work on this. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, close the informational hearing on LC 215. Open an informational hearing on additional potential member bills for 2014. Colleagues, I have nothing else that I know of that is coming. Obviously, bill referrals have not yet happened, but I would open the floor to any member of this committee that has a bill that may be coming to this committee to discuss openly what they see coming down the pipeline.
Mr. Chair, if I smell a rat in my other committee where it would likely go, I may come to you.
That's fair. That's okay. Fair. I'll take that as a compliment. Good. Well, seeing nothing further then, I would say keep your eyes open on bill referrals. I'm sure there will be other things that will be referred to this committee. You can tell from today that even just with the testimony we've had so far, we will have our work cut out for us. Barring any further comment, close the informational hearing on potential member bills, and committee is adjourned. See you in February.